Well, friends, we turn this evening to the book of Nehemiah and chapter 4 this evening, and we're going to begin to look at these things together that are given to us here. Let me get my papers right. There we are. And we will almost certainly turn to this chapter again, but I want to, in a sense, to take my text from verse 6, although we will look at this chapter and we will look at a number of other references in the book this evening, because I want to demonstrate and to try to emphasize what we're being told here in this way. So Nehemiah chapter 4 and verse 6, the end of the verse has this comment: "For the people had a mind to work." The people had a mind to work. "So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work." You remember how Paul encouraged the believers Philippians, in that reading in Philippians, that we would stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel, and not in any way terrified by your adversaries. Well, here were the people of God, and they had many adversaries, and by the grace of God, they were not terrified, but they stood together in one spirit and one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. In a sense, that's the New Testament commentary, if you like, on these wonderful words. Wall building. Well, we looked at that in chapter 3, and we saw how they were united and worked together, and how that began with the foundations. We looked at a whole number of situations there: the foundations, the material, the workmen, the leadership, and then the people, and how they worked together with the encouragement of true enthusiasm and the danger of indifference, but the strength of family involvement and the blessing of earnest zeal. Well, those were some of the things that we thought about. Well, this is a book for a worker, the worker in God's kingdom, the people who are committed and seek to go forward. It's amazing how easy distractions come in, and how we can be sidetracked by all kinds of things that take us away from the main work. And these things will come and discourage us so often as Christians, as believers. They knew that in this chapter, didn't they? Particularly in verse 10, Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is failing, and there is so much rubbish that we are not able to build the wall." Much rubbish. And this stopped them from working effectively. Although they had a mind to work, and they wanted to work, and they had a zeal to work. And we'll come to how they deal with that when we get there, and how their adversaries were overthrown. Now, as we have seen, the Babylonian Empire was thrown down by the Medes and Persians in 539 BC, and Cyrus the Persian, with an enlightened policy, encouraged the people who had been transported away from their land to go back to their lands. So this wasn't just something that happened to the people of God. It happened to lots of the nations. The Babylonians had deliberately, every land they conquered, they would take the people, the cream of the people, and they would transfer them to another place. Not necessarily all to Babylon, but to a different country. And so they would conquer a nation over here, and they would transfer the people over here. And they would conquer the nation there, and they would transfer the people of that nation over to somewhere else. And it was a great mixing up. And the reason for doing that was because if you take people away from where they are and put them down somewhere else, they've got to grow roots, and they've got to be established in that place. Very often, if people are taken out of their home situation and put somewhere else, they're not likely to rise up in rebellion against you. It was politically a very wise strategy by the Babylonians, but it was utterly cruel and decidedly wicked. But that's what they did. Well, why it was they took the Jews to Babylon and not dumped them somewhere else, as they did with some of the nations, we don't know. But in the providence of God, that's what happened. And the Babylonians became the means by which God fulfilled his promise. It wasn't his promise, it was his threat, wasn't it? That if they disobeyed him, they would be taken into captivity. I'm not sure threat's the right word, but his purposes. Because they had disobeyed him. And for 70 years, they were in captivity in Babylon. And of course, when the Babylonians were defeated by the Assyrians, when the Assyrians were defeated by the Babylonians, Actually, the situation in the country of exile eased to some extent. But then Cyrus came to the throne and gave this wonderful edict that allowed the people to return. First under Zerubbabel, and then a second group under Ezra, and now a third return under Nehemiah. And at each return, there was a real sense of revival, and God blessed the work and the people in a mighty way in each case. A great shame they didn't continue in that way, and many of the later prophets, what we call the minor prophets, had to deal with that. Not all of them, but many of them, a number of them prophesied in that time and had to bring them back to God again. Nehemiah comes comes to Jerusalem with the aim of restoration in mind. After all the hardships of exile and the ravaging of the land and the destruction of Jerusalem, he comes back looking for God to bless, expecting God to work. And he worked hard at rebuilding. And the wonder was the people joined with him. And while they faced some further opposition, as we're going to see in chapters 5 and 6, yet they pulled together with a remarkable way. And with all the discouragements, they continued to follow God. And that was an amazing testimony. And verse 6 tells us why. For the people had a mind to work. The people had a mind to work. They worked. And in fact, they worked very fast indeed. Remember, they had no JCBs. They had none of the high-powered machinery that we have today to build rocks and stones and everything else. And yet, as we find when we get later on, it took 52 days to rebuild the wall. That is an incredible speed in those days. And yet, although they were getting on with the job of restoration in Jerusalem, there were inevitably signs of opposition. Because, my friends, whenever God is at work, the devil will do his utmost to stop it. There is never a time in Christian work, in this side of eternity, where we will find there is no opposition, no distraction, no discouragement. What is the great answer to all of those? The people had a mind to work. The people had a mind to work. And my friends, we need to have a long-term view in all our work for God. Now, what I'm going to do this evening is to have a brief look at some of the causes of unrest and distraction. We will refer back to chapter 2, we'll refer on to chapter 6, we'll look at one or two others. We'll come back to this chapter 4 to look at one or two things from the end of the chapter on another occasion. But consider these things this evening. Chapter 2, verse 10, we read that Sanballat and Tobiah, the official, they were deeply disturbed. They were very cross that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel, even before the people of Israel had understood it. The enemy was at work. So let's consider some of these. Firstly, we're going to look at what I'm going to call derision. Derision. They had to face derision. We've seen that already in chapter 2 and verses 18 to 19, where when Nehemiah tells these officials of the good hand of God upon him, they said to him, "Rise up, let us rise up and build." And they set their hands to this good work. That's echoing the verse of our text today. The people had a mind to work. But, verse 19, when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they laughed at us and despised us and said, "What is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king?" And we looked at Nehemiah's response to that in verse 20 on a previous occasion. Many discouragements. And as we come to chapter 4, we find that this, we might say, is hotting up. Chapter 4, when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he is now not angry, he is furious and very indignant and mocked the Jews and sought to set them off. And Tobiah says, "Well, even if they build a wall, a fox will break it down." I mean, can you imagine what discouragement that is? Derision. And friends, sometimes derision is a form of persecution. We may not face the kinds of persecutions that some of our Christian brothers and sisters do in other parts of the world. But we can be derided, we can be laughed at, we can be scorned. And they come because of the tensions of the Christian life. The world knows nothing about that. The godless will ridicule the Christian because he has no idea of the tensions in the Christian life. Why are there tensions? Well, it is because of who we are and what we are. There are always tensions in the Christian life. And as we take a long-term view, we begin to understand that. Discouragements will come our way. In fact, if we always had peace and joy, there is a sense in which we might get so satisfied with it, we would lose the sense of the wonder of the grace of God. But there are tensions. Paul talks about that, doesn't he, in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. He talks about the tension between this life and the life to come. That was actually referred to in the psalm setting that we sang from Psalm 115. It was actually reflected to some extent in some of the words we read in Philippians. It was reflected in one of the readings this morning in our morning's message. The tension between this life and the life to come. And there is a tension, isn't there, my friends? Paul says there are times when in this body we groan. Do you ever groan? I'm sure there are times when we groan, don't we? We face the heat and the burden of the day. Maybe we have to face trials and tribulations, sicknesses, difficulties. The fact that we live in a fallen world, there are tensions, there are problems, there are difficulties. We know that we're destined to a place of glory and perfection. But these tensions are here because we're children of two worlds. Paul spoke about that, didn't he? After the glories of Romans 8, he yearns for the conversion of his own people in Romans 9. We see the tension that there is there in Paul's mind as he is concerned for his own people, having lifted us up into glory in chapter 8. Don't we face that? We have a desire that people will be converted. Was that not... Sure, there are many other reasons, but I'm sure one of the major reasons for our special evangelistic meeting yesterday was because we have a yearning that these people will become Christians, that they will come to love the Lord our God and will enter into the joys of salvation. And there's a tension there because, we don't know what will happen. The Lord can overrule in the coming days and maybe apply these, but we don't know. But we have a yearning, we have a tension there because of that. We're children of two worlds. We're here in this world, but we long for glory. We're somewhere between the start of the race and the finish of it. Now, you talk to anyone who runs a marathon, and they'll tell you what happens. I remember when I was a youngster, we used to have to do cross-country runs. And you know where they did it in Leicester with the school that I went to? They did it in the sewage farm. I can never understand that, but it was filthy and it was dirty. I know that... It actually sounds worse than it was, but it was pretty bad. And I can remember one year going and running, and I hated this long distance running anyway. It wasn't my cup of tea in the slightest. I remember running around this sewage farm one year, and it was particularly wet and it was particularly muddy. I don't know how many miles we ran, 10 miles maybe, something like that maybe, 8 or 10 miles, something like that, and most of the day we seemed to be running. And it was a filthy, dirty day. And I was covered in mud by the time I got back. My shorts were muddy. My shirt was muddy. My everything was muddy. And so we go back to the place where we started from. And there were our school clothes. We were supposed to change out of our shorts and our things and put on our school clothes to go home. What happens when we get back? The showers aren't working. I can remember the journey back from that place on the bus with my school clothes wrapped up carefully in my school satchel in the filthy, muddy clothes because I knew if I took them off, I'd have to put my, what could I do? What could I do? I tell you, that journey home was dreadful. I still dream about it sometimes now. Somewhere between the start and the finish. My friends, we know that, don't we? We face this world and we're running in this world and the devil comes and he chucks mud at us. And he does everything he can to stain us and to stop us and to do everything to oppose. And we long for that day when we'll be finally clear of it and finally clean with that purity and holiness of heaven. And there's a tension there. The tension maybe when we were younger, when our parents said we're going on holiday and then we're waiting for the day of the holiday and we can't wait, or on the journey, Dad, are we there yet? Dad, are we there yet? I'm sure we all said it, well, there we are. Or the tension when you're engaged and you're not yet married and there's tension where you're waiting. There's an ache, there's a longing. Friends, don't we know something of that? A spiritual ache, longing for heaven to come, for the battle to be over. Even so, come, Lord Jesus. Now be careful, that's not a selfish prayer. To save us from trouble and the hardships and discouragements. But where we are, it's the result of living between immaturity and perfection. Now here for Nehemiah, it was the tension of an incomplete project. The project wasn't yet finished. And here comes the opposition from Sanballat and company, and derision. And what is Nehemiah's reaction? Well, as we find in this book, he prays. And we get a lot of these, what we might call little prayers, these short prayers. Sometimes they're called telegram prayers. I think they were a bit more than that, but they are that sentence. We get this often. And so right in the middle of the account, I hope you noticed it as it was read to us this evening, in verses 4 and 5. Nehemiah, as it were, stops from his account of the history and he turns to God. Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads and give them as plunder to a land of captivity. Do not cover their iniquity and do not let their sin be blotted out from before you, for they have provoked you to anger before the builders. Verse 6, so we built the wall. And he goes back to the history. Brick by brick, stone by stone, section by section, continuing faithfully on in spite of the opposition, every part important, however small and however insignificant. And our responsibility may be small, perhaps, but it's no less important than anyone else's. The danger when we face opposition is to slacken off and to give up and to settle for less than the best and therefore to miss out on the blessings that God has promised to those who are faithful. What a challenge. There's much work to do, but it's worth it. Secondly, exhaustion. Now we find this described again in verses chapter 4 and verses 7 and 8. The people had a mind to work. Now it happened, verse 7, when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, and Ammonites and so on heard the walls were being restored, that they became very angry, and all of them conspired together to come to attack Jerusalem and create confusion. Nevertheless, we made our prayer to God. But they came to exhaust them. Chapter 6 and verse 4. Four times, we read, they came to Nehemiah to try to distract him and to exhaust him. I love the old, I think it's the old authorized version. It might be the Geneva Bible, I can't remember, but one of the early versions says this. Come and let us meet in the villages of Ono. Then Nehemiah said, oh no. All right? That's what he said, oh no. Well, the world wants to exhaust us. The world wants to prevent the work going forward. And sometimes its attractions are tempting. And sometimes we can be exhausting people. Are you an exhausting person or an inspiring person? Bless you, my friends. I don't think any of you are exhausting. But you know people who are exhausting? You know, you go into there and you think, oh dear, I can't face speaking to this person. He'd never stop speaking. I'll never do this. You know, and they're overwhelming and they exhaust us. Once you get a reputation as an exhausting person, it's very difficult to lose it, isn't it? But the devil's like that, doesn't he? He comes along, he wants to exhaust us. He wants to make it easy for us to be distracted or to freeze us up with temptation. Or to exhaust us by sheer effort. And what does Nehemiah do? Well, he takes it again to prayer. Verse 9, nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them we set a watch against them day and night. We'll come back to that on another occasion. Derision, exhaustion. Thirdly, diversion. Chapter 4, verses 11 and 12. Our adversaries said, they will neither know nor see anything till we come in their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. Well, thank goodness they'd as we might say, caught a sight of this. They weren't taken by surprise. But that's what the enemies planned. Oh, it didn't work. Chapter 6, verses 1 to 3. Again, the enemies heard that he had been rebuilding the wall. There were no breaks left in it, but the gates were not up. This was the last chance to really have a go. And how does Nehemiah deal with their temptations? I am doing a great work. I cannot come down. Nehemiah's response was practical. Now, you know, in Pilgrim's Progress, Bunyan describes a man, well, we don't know immediately his name, but we find out his name later. And we know from the book, and if you read Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, you know about him. He is Demas, and he has a silver mine. But when Christian and Hopeful meet him, they don't know his name to start with. They find it out much later. And he does his utmost thing to lure Christian off course, to see his silver mine, to distract him off the path of righteousness, to lure him away to money and riches. And now, we're not saying that, Bunyan is not saying that riches and money are evil in and of themselves, but the temptation to follow after that and to be distracted from going along the ways of God. Christian and Hopeful have just had a long discussion with three people, and Bunyan's names are always indicative of character. One man is called By Ends, and the next man was called Money Love, and the third man was called Hold the World. All right, that's how that describes their character. By Ends, Money Love, and Hold the World. And they were the companions that Christian and Hopeful had been talking to. And they were trying to distract them earlier. But now Christian and Hopeful have moved on, and By Ends, and Money Love, and Hold the World are behind them. And let me read this from Pilgrim's Progress. Then Christian and Hopeful outwent them, that's those three again, until they came to a delicate plain called Ease. Place called Ease. Remember, Bunyan is always describing these things as to how we would react. And they went there with much content. Easy it was. It was an easy time. But the plain was narrow, so they were quickly over it. Now, at the farther side of that plain was a little hill called Lucre, L-U-C-R-E, Lucre, we get the phrase filthy lucre from it, that, all right, you understand. And in that hill, a silver mine, which some of them that had formerly gone that way, because of the rarity, had turned aside to see it. But going too near the brim of the pit, the ground being deceitful under them broke, and they were slain. Some had been maimed there, and could not to their dying day be their own men again. Then I saw in my dream that a little off the road over against the silver mine stood Demas, gentlemanlike, says Bunyan, to call passengers to come and see, who said to Christian and his fellow, "Ho, turn aside and I'll show you something. Here there's something to look at." Doesn't tell him what to start with. No idea who this man was. At this moment, Christian and Hopeful don't know his name is Demas. They don't know that he's trying to distract them. They know nothing about it. Is this lawful? Is this right? Is that profit? Listen to Christian's answer. What thing so deserving as to turn us out of the way to see it? What a tremendous answer of faith. We are on the road to heaven. We are seeking to follow God. You say, come over here and see this. Is it worth it? Ah, yes it is. Here is a silver mine, says Demas, and some are digging in it for treasure. If you will come with a little pains, you will richly provide for yourself. Well, Hopeful turns to Christian and says, let's go. Let's go and have a look at it. Money. You know, it might help us on our way. We're poor pilgrims. We've got nothing to take us. And it's been very hard. Now, Christian has learned a lot of lessons over his time. This is fairly well on in the book. And Christian says this, not I. I have heard of this place before now and how many there have been slain. And besides, that treasure is a snare to those who seek it, for it hinders them in their pilgrimage. And Christian quoted Demas saying, is not the place dangerous? Has it not hindered many in their pilgrimage? And Bunyan quotes Hosea chapter 4, verse 8. Well, I won't stop with it now, but it's worth when you read Bunyan's book to see where he gets his verses from in the Bible. Demas says, not very dangerous, except to those who are careless, but he blushed as he spoke, says Bunyan. Then said Christian to Hopeful, let us not stir a step, but keep in the way. And Hopeful said to Christian this, I will warrant you that when Byends comes up, if he has the same invitation, he will turn in and see. Christian says, no doubt thereof, for his principles will lead that way, and 100 to 1, but he will die there. But we're going to keep on the way. Now, my friends, that's the kind of pressure that we face, isn't it? Diversion. That's what the world wants to do. It wants to divert us from the truth. It wants to turn us aside. Well, that wasn't quite the end of the story, because Demas calls again and says, will you not come over and see? And then he discovers who his name is. Christian says, you're an enemy to the right ways of the Lord of this way and have already been condemned by one of his majesty's judges. Besides, if we all turn aside, our Lord the King will certainly hear of it and will there be put to shame where we would stand with boldness before him. And Demas cried out again, he was one of their fraternity. He was one of the believers. He's not doing anything wrong. Just come and have a look. Walk over and talk to us. Then said Christian, what is your name? Demas, I am the son of Abraham. Christian says, no, you're not. You're the son of Gehazi was your great-grandfather, and Judas your father. Well, you know Judas and Gehazi in the Bible, don't you? It is a devilish prank that you use. Assure thyself that when we come to the king, we will tell him of this your behavior. And they went their way. And along come Byends and his companions, and they at first look go over to Demas. And Bunyan says, whether they fell into the pit by looking over the brink, whether they went down to dig, whether they were smothered in the bottom, of these things I am not certain, but I observe they were never again seen in the way. Christian had the sense and the wisdom not to be sidetracked, not to be taken away from the truth. My friends, there are so many diversions that will divert us from the truth. And I've met people over the years of my life who have fallen into that kind of trap. They have been led aside by things which superficially seem perfectly okay. But for them it has been a snare. Nothing that you could turn into the Bible and say this is wrong, that they have done the wrong. But to them it was a snare that led them away from the truth. I met folk who have been born in Christian homes and they've grown up and they've gone to university, and I know one or two people, and people often used to say, well, when one of our children goes to university, that is the big temptation time. Sometimes it is, but quite often the bigger temptation is when they leave university. And I've known people go to university and they've been leading lights in the Christian Union and in seeking to evangelize students and working for God, and then when they have got their degree and they've gone into the world and they begin to earn money, somehow it leads them astray. And I've known a number of people who have shipwrecked their faith. You have to ask whether they were genuinely born again, who have done so much for the work of God in their younger years, but something has happened that's turned them aside. And that is tragic, my friends. Whether it's a Demas situation, whether it's some other situation, but they have been led astray. Many diversions come to us. How we need to sort out our priorities. There are many things that are utterly praiseworthy, but we can be busy doing the wrong things. Diverted. And there are many ideas and many actions today to trap the unwary. What does Nicodemus do? Well, he acts practically. Look at what he does. Chapter 4, he sets a watch. In chapter 6, he sends messengers. He doesn't go himself, but sends messengers. He had a single-minded aim for God's glory. But he was helped and encouraged by the words of our text. For the people had a mind to work. And that's wonderful. when you have a servant of God or servants of God and they work together and they go on together. What a great blessing that is. Fourthly, and finally and briefly, there were also threatenings. Chapter 4, verse 3, Tobiah the Ammonite, whatever they build, if even a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. Chapter 6, verses 5 to 7, Sanballat sends his servants for the fifth time with an open letter reporting evil. Reporting among the nations, and Geshem says it, that you and the Jews plan to rebel. Therefore, according to these rumors, you are rebuilding the wall that you may be their king, and so on. And what is he doing? Well, we have a phrase today which is called fake news. Well, this was fake news. This was deliberate, malicious slandering. Without going into details, and it wouldn't be right for me to say, but some of the conversations I've had with our brother Gwyn over this weekend have spoken of a situation that he is having to deal with, where a pastor has been accused, falsely accused, utterly slanderously accused by people who hate him and hate the church where he works and hates the gospel and have spread slanders about. My friends, that happens, that happens. Sometimes the most noble of people can be slandered by unreasonable words and comments, threatenings to try to lead astray, to try to distract. Nehemiah was a man with a one-track mind. He was determined to serve God. He put God first, whatever the cost and whatever the consequences. And his greatest encouragement was the fact that the people with him had a mind to work. What a wonderful thing. What a wonderful thing. My friends, I think in the best way, we saw that illustrated over this last week. The way you have worked, the way people have worked together for the event yesterday. The unity, the harmony, having a mind to work. Bless you, my friends. Well, how wonderful. I didn't plan to preach on this verse tonight. This is just where we've got to. But how wonderful. What a blessing. We're not saying everything's all right. Of course there isn't. There are hardships and difficulties. And we would love to see many, many people converted. We would love to see this church full. And we're not there yet. But I believe there's a unity and a harmony and a blessing. As God himself, I trust I'm not speaking in the wrong way, but smiles upon us as we seek to do his work. And may we know his blessing in the days to come as we work together. Whatever oppositions, whatever difficulties we may face, whatever problems there may be, whatever distractions the devil may bring, whatever temptations we may face, we may have a single-minded aim to serve our God and glorify his name, to stand fast for the Lord Jesus, to have a mind for work to him. That's the greatest encouragement we can be in the work of the gospel. You know the hymn we're going to sing in a moment or two. Who is on the Lord's side? Who will serve the King? By thy grand redemption, we will serve you. We will honor you. We will glorify your name. We will work together, united together. I was telling Rob before this service, I went through the hymn book, trying to find hymns for this evening that spoke about what we together as the people of God, or us. There are lots of hymns about I and me and you, but lots of hymns that speak in the plural, but they're speaking about of our response to God. But there are very few hymns which actually talk about the unity of God's people working together. We sung one of them. We're going to sing another one in a minute or two. Who is on the Lord's side? Who for him will go? By thy call of mercy, by thy grace divine, we are on the Lord's side. Saviour, we are thine. But how can we do it? We can only do it as God keeps us. And that casts us upon his mercy, doesn't it? And encourages us to be faithful and God-honoring and God-glorifying so that we can sing, as the last verse says, Master, thou wilt keep us. You will keep us by thy grace divine, always on the Lord's side. Saviour, always of thine. May that be our testimony. May we be men and women who have a mind to work, to serve God, to glorify his name, and to do his bidding. Well, may the God, Lord bless us with these things. Let's turn then to 720 in the hymn book. 720. Who is on the Lord's side? Who will serve the King? And may the Lord bless us as we consider these things tonight.